Of all the meal scenes in the Bible, not many involve breakfast. But here we have eight people on the beach around a charcoal fire, Peter and Jesus and six others. Jesus had cooked them breakfast. It's the only time we have a story of Jesus actually cooking. He'd made bread multiply and made wine from water, but we hadn't seen him actually cook. Here he is, preparing fish. I wonder if he needed anything to start the fire. Did he hum, "It Only Takes a Spark"? Do you think that if he could get 153 fish to jump into a net, he could make them taste amazing? As darkness became dawn, they gathered after a night of fishing. They were hungry, their nerves were jangling, and the muscles were talking from that big haul of fish. Peter was still wet, and as he leaned over the fire to get more fish and warm bread, the water from his clothes and hair dripped into the fire, causing it to hiss and crackle. Just being around Jesus, the living, breathing Jesus, must have been electric a long time before electricity was harnessed and a long time before anyone would have used that word. The conversation hummed and hissed too, as I imagine it, now that I'm done imagining the naked Peter Carl so vividly gave us last week. There was banter. Jesus was teasing them about not catching fish until he showed up. John and the others were teasing Peter about jumping out of the boat and leaving them to drag all the fish to shore without him. And when we think of the best meals of our lives, the food has something to do with it, to be sure, but it's usually far more than the food. It's the setting, the company, the conversation. And this breakfast on the beach was a meal for the books. This meal was probably one they never forgot. Best meal ever. Far different than that Passover that gave us communion. A new day breaking, a new thing becoming, post-resurrection. Jesus turns to Peter. The others gathered probably said, "Oh boy, here comes." Peter sucked in a breath. He was still racked with guilt over having denied his friend, the man he would do anything for, by renouncing him that night of the crucifixion. In the days since, Peter was unsure how he'd recover, unsure how he'd go on. The other disciples and followers of Christ rode waves of fear of the unknown, fear of others in that context. But Peter also had to deal with the shame of what he'd done. Fishing calmed him, and he was safe on the water. That's probably why he had gone out on this night. "Peter, do you love me?" "You know that I love you," Peter said. It was the best he could do out of his shame. Jesus, in that simple way, said, "Feed my sheep." Now, we know that Jesus used stories and images that resonated with the people of that era. We go back over and over again to the stories full of vines and sheep and bread and fish. He talked to people who lived from the land and water. On the beach that morning, Jesus didn't talk to the fishermen about fish. He talked to him about sheep. "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter, starting to get annoyed, said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." First it was feed the sheep, and now tend them. Peter hated hearing about sheep. He was a fisherman. He didn't understand the dumb four-footed beasts. He didn't like them, and here was Jesus telling him, "Tend my sheep." Jesus said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" The passage tells us that Peter felt hurt because of the three questions. Jesus filleted Peter like a fish, scraping raw places. Peter, exasperated, replied, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep." The most common takeaway from this story is that it was redemption for Peter's previous denial. To go deeper, this was a moment where Jesus engaged a fragile Peter and loved him back. He gave Peter something to do and showed him how to do it. Chris Minowa, of the band Cloud Cult, recently told Krista Tippett on the radio show On Being that sometimes we have an ultimate moment of fragility where love is able to come outside of the skin. On that lake, in that water, on that beach, Peter and Jesus had that kind of moment. The crackling conversation became a crackle of their love for each other. For us, the moment also shows us a way to be a follower of Jesus. Sets of three aren't uncommon in the Bible. Three denials, 3 days, three temptations of Christ. Roy Peter Clark, a journalist and writing coach, says that the number of elements in a sentence or paragraph matters. One has power. True. Racist. Homophobe. Those words are punches in the gut. Even the phrase, "Jesus wept," though having two words, acts as a unit of one with power. Two elements get used for comparison and contrast. Mom and dad. Ham and eggs. Bernie and Hillary. Three gives us completeness, wholeness, roundness. Creator, Redeemer, and Holy Spirit. Larry, Moe, and Curly. Trump, Cruz, and Kasich. What if these three sheep phrases are really the essence of the gospel, a complete version here? Feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Feeding, tending, hospitality. On the beach that morning, the beauty is that in this conversation of love, Jesus gave Peter a path to redemption. He gave him something to do. He gave him a way to move out of the shame and guilt and live that love. For those of us who want to know what we can do in this Christian life, Jesus gives us three ways to show our love for him as well, for those with which we share this world. But Jesus isn't done. He moves deeper into this mystery. On this morning, Jesus said to Peter, "Follow me." Now, there are two ways to interpret this. One of them has meaning in the moment. We don't really know if they were walking down the beach, but it could simply mean, "Come with me down the beach." And John, who refers to himself in the text in ways that seem stilted to us as modern readers, ends up in the conversation or about him between Jesus and Peter. When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Follow me." So the rumor spread in the community that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" It could be that decades later, as an old man, John writes about being old, about being a follower of Christ, still waiting for Christ to come back. When I was young, in the religious context in which I was raised, the return of Christ was important. We were all waiting for it. The rapture mattered. I no longer think much about it. It's a lot more interesting to think about how to be a follower of Christ in this fascinating, broken world that keeps evolving and erupting. I want to be a seeker, not just someone waiting. So I think that Jesus also meant a larger follow me, not just down the beach. After the sheep gospel lesson, he left them with two words, delivered with power, follow me. The Greek word that gave us the word Christian means follower of Christ. Being a follower of Jesus was risky and maddening. It means a lot of not knowing, particularly after this guy had died and come back. It meant living with mystery. And a lot of the time, it meant trying to figure out what he meant and how to do what he said. Still does. It still does. The physics are different. We can't see or touch Jesus. But there's still physicality. When it comes to feeding, Jesus called himself the bread of life. He said, do this in remembrance of him. And here were instructions to feed others. Now, we have to somehow dispense with this sheep language. Even those who love to take the Bible literally in our day and age don't carry around shepherd's crooks. So this is love one another cloaked in sheep's clothing. It's why we take casseroles to people, give to the window, and teach Sunday school. Within these walls, in Goshen, and in this world, we do these things, the heart of the gospel, wearing smelly wool. Take in refugees, help the needy, be hospitable. These are things that we can do. We now live in a technological information-based society on the other side of the Industrial Revolution. The world explodes constantly with new information, gadgets, and distractions. These days, Jesus wouldn't likely use sheep and grapevines as examples. He would still use bread, because bread is still fundamental, even in a gluten-free era. If we are to feed people, what do they hunger for? What is it they need to navigate this world in which we all live? There's actual food, but there's more. For the last number of months, we've watched campaigns, heard the slogans, seen the bumper stickers and yard signs. The candidates try to get us to follow them. There have been people lauding candidates for speaking the truth, for standing up to the establishment. Some candidates have tapped into the fear, anger, and cynicism that is pervasive in the United States these days. We don't know what will happen in Indiana's primary on Tuesday or in November. But what I do know is that people in this country are scared. People are fighting cynicism and craving hope. That seems like a prime opportunity for the body of Christ to feed the lambs, tend the sheep, and feed the sheep. We should patch brokenness with love and hope. We must first stoke the charcoal fires of hope within ourselves and within each other, and then try to offer it to others. If some fish and bread is heated in the process, all the better. We don't really know the way forward. We know what has been. We try to live in the moment, and we wonder about the future. A wise mentor of mine once said, if we really knew what was going to happen in the future, it would scare us too much, and we wouldn't want to go there. The disciples were in the same place that morning on the beach when Jesus said, follow me. To be a seeker means to ask questions, to wrestle with this old book, to cast a net on the side that we don't usually, to seek the light. To be a follower of Christ means putting ourselves in a place of vulnerability, not of power. It means choosing a man who lived nearly 2,000 years ago over a man or woman who claims they know how to lead this country. One of them is everlasting. The other will last at most 8 years. As the Avett brothers sing, your life doesn't change by the man or woman that's elected. If you're loved by someone, you're never rejected. For us, in this congregation, it means loving to the point that others won't yet go. It means living with the questions. It means not really knowing, but still trying. The disciples, the seven of them on the beach that morning, got an amazing breakfast with the man they loved. They got more of Jesus. He said, "Follow me," and was gone again. Soon he was gone for good, at least in body, and they were left trying to figure it out. Anne Lamott, in that lovely book, Traveling Mercies, wrote, "E.L. Doctorow once said that writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way." She says, you don't have to see where you're going. You don't have to see your destination or everything you will pass along the way. You just have to see 2 or 3 feet ahead of you. This is right up there with the best advice on writing or life I have ever heard. Together, we shine our feeble little lights. We do the modern equivalents of fishing and shepherding. We try not to completely lose our way as we try to follow the one who called us, as we seek. Like the disciples, we gather together to try to figure out what it means to live the words, "Follow me."